We should stand with the Haitian people against this narrative and continue to provide solidarity and to struggle against our government's or the United States government's efforts to dominate Haiti.
Great. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me, and thank you for the important work that you're doing.
Thank you, Margaret. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that's all for today. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Pacifica Radio is listener sponsored. If you like what you heard today, consider becoming a Clearing the Fog buddy by making a monthly donation to WBAI.org. Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Chris Bernadel. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Coming up next is an ecologic special talking about the anniversary of the Clean Water Act. 50 years.
Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth? Share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom, peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. A parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, then telling where we gonna plant our seed.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
Sally Gellert. And I'm Donnie Stein. This is Ecologic, October 25th, 2022.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today we have echo, Ken.
Keep going.
Today we have guests to help us celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. Manna Joe, please introduce yourself. Re-record, press 3.
Manna Joe, are you there?
If you're satisfied with the message, press 1. Oh, no. To listen to your message, press 2.
Yep, I,
to erase and re-record.
I see your hat. Manny, you need to speak up.
I am here. Great. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the Clean Water Act.
So,
okay.
Hi.
Our second guest will be Pete Lopez, who should be joining us in just a minute.
I hope so.
I need to call him.
All right. All right, Peter, can you hear us?
The Clean Water Act was signed 50 years ago last week. And we're here to celebrate this important 50th anniversary. Last week, our transmitter tower was being repaired, so we're a week late.
Okay. So, how are we doing on getting a guest on the phone? Peter, are you online? Okay. Well,
we don't seem to have Peter. I keep getting his answering machine. So, did you talk about the Silent Spring and the Cuyahoga River, Donna?
No. Tell us about that.
Because the Clean Water Act, it wasn't, Nixon just didn't do it out of goodness of his heart. When Silent Spring by Rachel Carson came out in 1962, an environmental movement started up, oriented towards pesticides and nuclear weapons, but it grew and grew. And then in 1969, the Cuyahoga River caught fire. It was going through Cleveland, and it caught fire. And it was something that the people of Cleveland are still living down. The waterworks, I understand, are sort of owning up to it now. But I remember I was a kid in school, and everybody was talking about a river that caught fire. How does a river catch fire? And that made people understand just how polluted the waterways of America were, that a river can catch fire. And so even President Nixon, who had a whole lot of oil people in his cabinet as his advisors, they had to pay attention. And the organizations from all over the country were involved, including Riverkeeper, and in this area, and Clearwater. Manny Joe, can you tell us about Clearwater's involvement in getting the Clean Water Act passed 50 years ago?
Be my pleasure to. Can you hear me? Right?
Yep, we hear you.
Me okay?
Yep, we hear you fine.
The reason it was
Oh boy.
Manager,
we're not hearing you well. Oh boy.
On some maps, it was so pretty, they didn't even consider it a river. You could tell what color it was because they would squeegee the leftover solvent and paint directly into the river. There was raw sewage floating in the river, oil slick, and it really was in terrible shape. And Pete Seeger and the original founders of Clearwater really wanted to try to do something about that. So shortly after we were launched, we sailed up and down the Hudson River and collected signatures calling on Congress to pass or to upgrade federal legislation to protect our waterways across the nation, and also to provide funding that would, for example, allow municipalities to build municipal sewage treatment plants. And so there had been a law, but it was not as comprehensive and also not being actively enforced. So after collecting thousands of signatures, Pete and the crew sailed to Washington, D.C. and held a congressional briefing calling for the Clean Water Act. And also a concert, and the story goes that Pete sang "This Land Is Your Land" in the hallowed halls of Congress, and that was considered a tipping point for the passage of the Clean Water Act. So that was 1970, and more signatures were collected, and more congressional visits. And in 1972, I believe it was October 18th, 1972, the bill was passed. And then President Nixon vetoed it, but there was bipartisan support to override that veto and bring this very strong landmark legislation into existence.
Wow, that's interesting. It's pretty rare that we get to override a presidential veto, especially on something so important.
It's pretty cool. And we have Pete. So, Peter, introduce yourself.
Well, hi, folks. Thank you for letting me join you. I'm Pete Lopez. I'm with Gina Cutson. I oversee the science, policy, and environmental advocacy portion of the Gina Cutson engagement. And happy to be on the show with you.
Sheena Cutson was working on Storm King during that time, right?
Absolutely. And again, we were all, Storm King was actually happening in the 60s, and so part of the environmental movement starting in the 60s, moving into the 70s with landmark legislation, the Clean Water Act. And matter of fact, EPA just celebrated its 50th 2 years ago. So a lot of things happening in that time period.
Yeah. Well, that was an optimistic time.
So, what has been accomplished so far with the Clean Water Act? Who wants to tackle that one?
Well,
Nana?
If I may, one of the main things is that there was funding, and municipalities installed sewage treatment plants. Now, that made the river a lot cleaner, but it didn't completely solve the problem. And we can talk a little bit about the unripped issues. But the other thing it did was regulate industrial discharges into the river. And back then, John Cronin was working with Pete Seeger, and he and a colleague went out and actually took samples from discharge pipes from industry. One of the famous cases is Tuck Tate, and that went all the way through the legal process, and they were fined and required to remediate their violations. But John Cronin says the shore near Tuck Tate looked like they were completely covered with adhesive. Those conditions were common until the Clean Water Act was passed and enforced. And that was one of the very first cases brought under the Clean Water Act. And it doesn't take a whole lot of enforcement before industry gets the message that they have to comply and they have to protect our waterways and, by extension, also the air and the ground.
And it's, so, no, go ahead, Pete.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to add to that a little bit. So back to Manager's observation. So we talked about regulating pollutant discharges, but it also allowed federal government to maintain existing and set water quality standards for all contaminants in surface water. Also, it allowed a focus on non-point source pollution, which can be as devastating as point source. And over time, other improvements led to the establishment of the Clean Water State Revolving Funds, which we rely on heavily in New York for water and wastewater system development and maintenance.
So the difference between point and non-point source?
So a point source would be coming out of a single pipe for ease. Generally, a wastewater treatment plant would be, an example of a point source. And a non-point would be runoff from fields. Uh-huh. So it might be agricultural runoff or some other sort of runoff coming into the water, but not necessarily through a pipe. It may be just leaching into a water body. And that could be anything from phosphorus to nitrogen to you name it. Any number of pollutants can leach into the water from non-point sources, pesticides, et cetera.
It includes, people's front lawns, the fertilizer.
Sure.
And so forth.
That's right. Yep, excessive fertilizer. And you have issues like that are big in certain areas. Long Island has had an issue for many years with phosphorus loading and non-point source discharges. And again, particularly around open fields where herbicides or pesticides are being sprayed, there's a danger for non-point discharge. So fertilizers, pesticides, things of that nature.
And certainly, those of you listening who are old enough may remember how smelly the Hudson River was when you were younger. And now it's clean enough that people are building luxury housing along the Hudson River. That was unthinkable 50 years ago. Nobody wanted to be within several blocks of the Hudson River. And that's true of rivers throughout the United States. And we have the Clean Water Act to thank for that. It's not perfect. And, whether it's swimmable and drinkable and fishable everywhere, well, of course, it's not that. It's technically fishable in the Hudson River, but they recommend people don't eat that fish.
And it changes according to the weather and precipitation. We have heavy rainstorm and the combined sewers flow into the river, it gets dirtier. When it's dry, it's cleaner.
It's even kayak. Right now, there's a lot of us who go into the water and enjoy the river. We couldn't have enjoyed the river 50 years ago.
No, you're right. Right. And back to the earlier point about fishing is, again, a major source of contamination are PCBs from GE's release of PCBs from the upper Hudson. And those bioaccumulate. They work their way up the food chain into the fish. And ultimately, if we eat them, we risk PCB contamination ourselves. And so, mm-hmm. So there are strict advisories against fish consumption in the Hudson.
I think I could add that in a particular disproportionate impact on people that eat the fish. Donna, are you hearing me? You're putting your hand
up. Yes, we are.
Okay. Okay, thank you. sometimes people from immigrants from other cultures where they rely on fishing and fish as an important part of their diet or really need that protein for subsistence. That can then, if that's the case, you may either not know about the health advisories or ignore them because you have to eat and feed your family. So, you know, it's just an important thing as we're working on, still working on cleaning up Riverside Beach.
Yeah, to add to manager's point, so there's an environmental justice piece here that resonates with all of us. So families and others who may rely, as you were saying, for subsistence purposes, are at risk and may not be aware or understand the impacts to their health and their family's health.
So let's talk and about
also, the
challenges that are coming up, and what can we do?
Can I just reiterate the actual health advisory is that it's an eat none health advisory for women of childbearing age and children, and very restricted amounts for adult males. So I just wanted to be clear, you know, here it is 50 years later, and this is a persistent problem that we are trying very hard to get the word out so that people can make informed decisions. Sally, I'm sorry I cut you off, but I wanted to make that point, if you don't mind.
That's really important. I know I've been up at Bear Mountain and seen signs, don't eat the fish, and I've seen people next to it sitting there crabbing, and hopefully they're tossing them back in. But, you know, if low income and you need food, and it's you can't see them, so it's hard. But it's important to stay away.
And I wonder how much they believe in those signs. You know, I grew up in the Jersey Shore, and I remember signs going up, don't swim. Don't swim today on, you know, such and such a date. And we're thinking, the water seems the same today as it did yesterday. So every kid disregarded every sign that said don't go swimming, and we went swimming anyway.
Yeah, I remember hearing about the Ramapolinape kids up by the Ford plant who, all that gorgeous paint looks so tempting. Mm-hmm. Don't realize how dangerous it is.
So there's that problem, too. And you're listening to Ecologic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Normally we're on Fridays from 2:30 to 2:55, but today we have a one-hour special talking about the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. And, you know, we're going to be talking about the good things, and we're going to be talking about the things that aren't so good. But there's a lot going on. And there's a lot of environmental groups throughout the United States working on keeping the water clean. And then we have the polluters working on doing the opposite. And our guests are Mana Jo. Reintroduce yourself.
Yes, Mana Jo Green. I'm the Environmental Action Director for Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. And I also serve on the Ulster County Legislature.
And Pete?
Pete Lopez, I'm Director of Science, Policy, and Advocacy for Stena Hudson.
And you also used to be a part of EPA Region 2.
I was. I was the regional administrator, and I also was a member of the Assembly, serving on the Assembly Environmental Conservation Committee.
So you come to this from a variety of directions. And I'm Ken Gale, and I am with
Sally Gellert.
And Donna Stein. We're co-hosts of Ecologic.
So what are some of the threats that, I guess we'll stick with the Hudson since Mana Jo and Pete were very active in that. What are the threats to the Hudson River nowadays that the Clean Water Act can help us with and has helped us with, for that matter? Mana Jo, we'll start with you.
Okay, well, what are known as emerging contaminants, things that weren't even considered, and maybe standards weren't set for these back when the Clean Water Act was passed. One of the most important ones we're dealing with here along the Hudson is a chemical called a series of chemicals called PFAS or PFOS, and these were used as firefighting foam. For example, at Stewart Air National Guard, they fairly routinely spread this to assure that there wouldn't be a fire as a plane landed. But then it got into a recreational pool, and then it got into the groundwater, and it ran off into other water bodies and ended up in Lake Washington, which is the drinking water supply. We talk about fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. The city of Newburgh water supply is contaminated with these chemicals. And fortunately, they were able to switch over to the New York City aqueduct, to that clean water supply. Mm. But people were drinking water, for years before this was discovered. So that's one example of challenges that we still face. I think Peter might have a few others.
I bet.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And thank you, Manager. I'll add to a couple. So, of course, everyone's familiar with, as we talked about, the PCB contamination in the Hudson. And that's an ongoing process. And sadly, the cleanup, healing the river, is seen to take decades, generations. So removing the contaminants is critical, finding them, identifying who contributed to the pollution, and having them pay for it. That's the process, having polluters pay for their contamination. But we've only gone as far as the Troy Dam with removing PCB. So even as we speak, EPA is in the Hudson south of the Troy Dam, just beginning its exploration. And so
Where is Troy? You speak of the Troy Dam. Where is the Troy Dam?
Yeah, Troy, New York, Rensselaer County. So just a little north of Albany. And that there were a series of dams that kind of impeded some of the flow of the original spill occurred further upriver, and the PCBs leached into the river and worked their way downstream. So much of the contamination was noted above the Troy Dam. There were a series of investigations and then removals, court actions that led to removal of incredible amounts of PCBs. But we believe, and EPA and others, the regulators believe, there's more to be found. So working south of Albany, ultimately to the mouth of the Hudson itself. So that would be one piece. The other thing that always a challenge is stormwater runoff and what we call combined sewer overflows, where you have stormwater and sewer in older systems where in periods of high water you have a flushing, if you would, of organic material into the rivers with overflow of drainage from streets and highways and city blocks. So that's an item that is a serious concern. I know that, for example, the city of New York has a massive issue with storm combined sewer overflows. And cleaning that up, remediating that will take many years and many, many millions of dollars to accomplish.
Yeah, there's a nice diagram of how a combined sewer overflow works on the Ecologic webpage, which is ecoradio.org. And what happens is when you have normal sewer stuff, it goes into a water treatment plant. There's pipes that take it there, but when you have rain as well, and it goes into the same system, it overloads the system. So there are overflow parts all over the pipe system, and so the sewage and whatever refuge and the rain ends up going into, in the case of New York City, the East River and the Hudson River. And most big cities in the United States have that kind of sewer system. So local waterways get polluted by sewage when there's too much rain for the sewage system to handle and get it to the water treatment plant. And when the sewage systems were built, you could do that because the population wasn't so big. Well, there's a lot more people now, and that's where the problem comes.
This just shows that there's so much more to be done. And Pete, is this something that can be done with how much money, how much community involvement, government involvement? What can be done to fix the sewer system?
Well, it's really a combination of factors. So we have really two approaches. We have enforcement. So we have the very direct engagement from agencies such as EPA or DEC, working hand in glove with the Attorney General's office or Department of Justice, respectively, to pursue communities and others who are discharging. And force them into making changes. That's one piece. The other piece that is linked to it and can help make it more manageable is where financial and technical assistance can be made available to also support. So there may be instances where someone is willfully polluting and they have the resources to fix it, but they're not. There may be other instances where they need support, either guidance, technical guidance, or funding to help make the improvements needed to achieve water quality standards.
I know in New Jersey we have a state infrastructure bank that towns can borrow revolving loans to improve their water quality systems. We've recently passed a stormwater authority bill, so towns can create stormwater authorities to start tackling some of these problems. I assume you have something similar.
Yes, in New York we have the Clean Water State Revolving Loan Fund, and we have the Environmental Facilities Corporation that helps administer and provide loans and grants. Other agencies also support. So in some cases, USDA, Rural Utilities, has funding available that often will assist with water and wastewater systems. And then municipalities, as you point out, can bond on their own, so they have the ability to borrow make improvements. Often when those projects occur, it's been my experience that there's usually a packaging of funding. There's usually not one source of funding that's sufficient to make a project whole. So it usually requires a combination of all the above.
And there's a lot of false solutions that keep people putting out. At one point, fracking was considered a solution to coal, and it was just as bad as coal. And nuclear power is considered a solution, and that's just as bad or worse. Mega dams are like, oh, well, that's clean energy, and it's not clean to anybody who lives near a mega dam or used to use the areas near a mega dam. So there's a lot of false solutions. And a lot of these false solutions, like, well, we can keep on polluting as long as we have a false solution that we're using at the same time.
I did have one more item that's a challenge, too, that I just wanted to flag. And this one is a little more insidious. So within many of our drinking water systems, particularly old systems in cities, lead pipes were used commonly to transport water. And so, Sally, back to your point, when I was with EPA, we worked closely with the city of Newark, with Mayor Baraka, to address a crisis with lead exceedances in their drinking water, affecting homes and Realm of Justice communities, families. And that plays out through upstate New York. It's a national issue. It's a national crisis. So we talk about lead in paint, but lead in your drinking water is just as much or sometimes a greater threat, and you may not even realize it's coming into your house through old lead pipes.
Yeah, we heard about it in Flint pretty obviously, and people don't realize how ubiquitous it is. So many places.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
So there's another item that needs attention, and that requires investment in infrastructure, identification of where the old pipes are, and removal and replacement of the lead pipes with piping that's appropriate and supports clean drinking water standards.
Yeah, there's old photographs of when the underground pipes to bring water in or out were made of wood, And it was such a big deal that they switched over to metal. All right, this is going to be great. This is how it's going to fix it, because the wood was deteriorating or rotting or whatever. And one new solution seems to give its own problems for later generations. Mm. And we have several people who want to talk to you guys. We have time to take phone calls today. So you want to take calls right away, or do you have something to tie up with?
Mana, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to give credit to the city of Newburgh for addressing the lead pool problem.
Mm.
They are being very proactive, taking the steps and doing what is necessary and getting the funding to correct that problem.
Yeah, I couldn't help but smile when you talked about firefighting chemicals in the water when we led off talking about rivers catching on fire. but at any rate, the call-in number is 212-209-2877. 212-279-2877. And I'm trying to bring the folks in, and how come pressing these buttons isn't working?
Must say we are glad to have our own Ken Gale be our engineer today.
I'm not so glad about it. All right. Why won't these?
It's only been 3 years since you've engineered, right?
Yeah, 3 years. I don't know why this isn't working.
Uh-oh.
Nope.
We have two guests who have plenty to say.
Well, this is true. I know what one caller wants to talk about, which is the big cable that they're talking about building from Canada and the forest of Quebec and Labrador all the way to Queens. And that will certainly disrupt those PCBs on the bottom of the Hudson River as those cables cross the Hudson. And then they'll build mega dams to supply the electricity for those cables when they have people, they'll flood the forest, put methyl mercury in the water of the forest, and can't get anybody in. And so now you're poisoning the fish or the people who live off of that, and the indigenous people of Canada. And the unions don't like it because they're taking their jobs away. It's going to mess up the Hudson River. And meanwhile, New York State is adding about 1 gigawatt, that's 1,000 megawatts, of solar energy and energy efficiency every year. So we don't need it anymore.
Yeah, so I guess I can jump in. And Mana, I've been tracking the Climate Action Council and the scoping plan and the integration analysis. Are you up to speed on that too, Mana Jo? So I'll just jump
yes.
in. So
go ahead.
What I would suggest is, so all of us are united in looking for a way to leave our fossil fuel past behind, and that's job number one. And so in New York, what the legislature and the governor are attempting to do is chart a path forward that would replace gas-fired plants, Athens Gen, Danskammer, to name a couple. You know, Danskammer is a peaker plant, and oil-fired plants and coal-fired plants, nuclear, replace it with renewable. And so that includes solar. There's also focus on wind, including offshore wind. And in the state's analysis and looking at the energy needs are massive. So the state's trying to identify where they can aggregate and site, that's another challenge, site these facilities, and then connect them to the grid. So another piece would include storage, because as we know, with our renewables, they're intermittent. So if the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining, for example, we have to find a way to capture that energy and store it. So that initiative is massive and expensive, and also has its own challenges. As I mentioned, siting the lines that carry the power to the generating facilities, to our homes and families and businesses. Citing the facilities themselves, where do they go? What communities are receptive to having commercial scale renewables in their communities? So even as we're adding the power on an annual basis, it's going to be many years and millions and billions, arguably, of funding to achieve that. And so the question is, how do we meet the needs now and keep our homes and families and communities operable as we try to make that transition? So we have fossil fuels and we have very limited other choices. So the Canadian Hydro is the state has made a decision to tap that for now. Maybe over time that becomes unnecessary as other renewable sources and technologies improve. But your point's well taken that, you know, when we pursue one good, sometimes it creates unintended consequences as a result.
Well, by then the mega dams in Canada will have been built and the forest land flooded. And so for that part of Canada, it'll be too late, even if, you know, we keep going 1,000 megawatts a year or more.
Yeah.
Because I understand during COVID, that 1,000 megawatts rate went up. More people are getting solar now than they were before COVID. So, I mean, we're nothing compared to Europe, all right? I wanted, you know, our European listeners to go, you know, well, we have 1,000 megawatts in 6 months, you know, what, you know, but or 5,000, which is certainly true. The United States lags behind most of the Western European countries, a lot of the Central American countries in putting up renewable energy and energy efficiency. But nevertheless, New York is doing pretty well on that regard. And every time you don't burn fossil fuel, the water is a little cleaner, the air is a little cleaner, we're a little healthier. So it's all a credit. That's why it fits in with the topic of the Clean Water Act.
Absolutely. And just go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that Clearwater has not taken a position on the Champlain-Hudson Power Express. But we are united in opposing new flooding because for the very reasons that you gave, the vegetation decaying and releasing methane. So that's which is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. So there is a consensus on that. And I also want to let folks know that Clearwater has partnered with New Yorkers for Clean Power and Scenic Hudson to help municipalities make wise siting decisions for renewable energy. We don't want to be cutting down our forests, which are so important to carbon sequestration, and we don't want to cover prime farmland, although there are ways of combining, for example, solar and agriculture. But we have a five-week training course that we've repeated. We're now on the fourth cohort of municipalities. And if anyone is interested, manageo@clearwater.org, and we'll keep you posted and get you into the next training.
Yeah, that's great. It gives communities a chance to look at their resources and prioritize for themselves what makes the best choice for their community.
And to support that, working with the manager's team and others, we have a solar mapping tool that we're using to help municipalities and others look at where responsible and appropriate placement might occur. And I guess just back to Ken's observation, the other challenge we have is that as we drive to move to away from fossil fuels, it's not just energy generating plants, it's cars, it's our homes, how we heat our homes. So the drive towards electricity means that current electricity demand will be eclipsed as we push ourselves away from the fossil fuels. So that's going to be the challenge, is finding enough renewable and enough storage capability to meet those needs. So anyway, I'll turn it back to you folks. Thank you.
And always think of efficiency first and conservation. And, you know, the watt point. You don't have to generate is the best one of all.
Absolutely.
And you're listening to an Ecologic Special on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Ecologic is normally on Fridays from 2:30 to 2:55, and we're doing a special here because it's the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, and it's something that is worthy of celebration. And we have, I'm Ken Gale, and my co-hosts are
Sally Gellert
and Donna Stein,
and our guests today are, start with Manna.
Manna Jo Green from Hudson River Sloop Clearwater.
And?
Pete Lopez with Scenic Hudson.
What's the current situation of the Clean Water Act? Is it still a strong 50 years later? Are courts still supporting it? Are there challenges?
I would say it is strong. It's a matter of implementation and the new challenges. So one thing we haven't brought up, but I think it's important, is climate change and the effect at Clearwater. We've come to the conclusion that climate change is the biggest challenge to the Hudson River moving forward. All of these other challenges we will continue to work on, but sea level rise can cause displacement, and we're encouraging strategic relocation planning ahead of, and the New York DEC has a really excellent program on resilience planning. The railroads, which are so important to transportation, are right in the floodplains on both sides of the Hudson River. There are also brownfields that are right now not causing a problem, but if sea level rises and those are flooded, then chemicals can be released.
What's a brownfield?
And a brownfield is a contaminated area. For example, a coal ash landfill would be considered a brownfield. And any other chemicals that were buried in the ground and sort of tucked away, but could still, right now they're not causing a problem, but they could. And also, and drought. These are important conditions that the Clean Water Act did not anticipate, but are real challenges to our waterways.
So there's a lot of challenges and a lot of victories, and it's always going to be something for Ecologic and Clearwater and Hudson and
Scenic Hudson
to do, because the polluters are not going to stop polluting. They're not going to care about what they're doing to our air and water. And so it's up to people like Manna Jo Green and Pete Lopez, who do care, and Donna Stein and Sally Geller, who do care, to make sure. And, of course, almost everybody listening to this show, I would say, are people who care and are trying to mitigate what the polluters are doing to our air and water, and I salute all of you.
Sometimes I think the polluters, it may not be so much they don't care, they just don't think about it. It's like, not my problem.
Yeah, and on that note, Matt, let's go a little bit back to some historical information. What other organizations were involved in the in bringing about the Clean Water Act? What other, besides Pete Seeger and Clearwater, what other organizations were right there with you?
I'm not sure I can answer that. There was the predecessor to Riverkeeper was the Hudson River Fishermen's Association. That was one of the early organizations. I would say that the Clean Water Act came into being as the environmental movement was forming. So Scenic Hudson was working on Storm King at the time, and, you know, I think this all coincides with the original Earth Day, which was in 1970, and that was a real shift in awareness that led to the Clean Water Act, the Clean Act. And if you don't mind a quick plug for New York's Environmental Bond Act, which is clean water, clean air, and green jobs, and that's on the ballot for New Yorkers. There's also right now a New York, New Jersey Watershed Protection Act that has passed in Congress. It's passed in the House but needs to pass in the Senate. And we also have other legislation that is pending that just needs to be signed. So there's a lot we can do to move this forward. It seems like an ever progressing process. And I also want to give credit to, since that focuses on your question, the Friends of the Clean Hudson was the original coalition for PCBs. And if we had more time, that's a list I could provide. But okay. We'll do it by email.
I really thank you. We have had a great information, great show. One last thing to promote is that on November 1st, there's going to be a press conference in Flotilla to commemorate the Clean Water Act in Peekskill. So all of us kayakers need to tune in to clearwater.org and find out about that, or email us at Ecologic. So as usual, the time flies by and we need to wrap it up, but thanks for joining us. You can find more information at www.clearwater.org and www.scenichudson.org.
And join us this Friday, October 28th at 2:30 p.m. for a commemoration of the 10th anniversary of Superstorm Sandy.
Our website has information on a variety of environmental topics. To listen to this show or any of our past shows, it's all at www.ecoradio.org.
That's www.ecoradio.org. We know the environment is important to you. That is why you listen to Ecologic, and we appreciate you. We need you to realize that this listener-sponsored radio station is yours. There is lots to do, and you can help. Here is a way to exert your influence on the world. Show your responsibility and love for WBAI and for Ecologic, and help keep us on the air. Yes, you have that much power. We know you want to hear more environmental news, so go to give2wbai.org, ecologic.wbai.org, leave out the www, and make your selection and pledge. Also, we would like to encourage each of you to become our buddy and a sustaining member with a recurring donation of $10 or more. Just go to www.give2wbai.org, go to the BAI Buddy page, and on the drop-down box, click on Ecologic and pledge a monthly amount. We really appreciate your pledge of any amount. Think of what this show is worth to you. You have our sincere thanks.
And those of you on Facebook, please like our page. Enter Eco-Logic.
You can't depend on mainstream media to discuss the details of the Clean Water Act from the people's perspective. WBAI and Ecologic take pride in being community radio, the voice of the people. WBAI offers unique programming, not interrupting it with ads from giant corporations, which is why you keep hearing us asking for your support so often. We need you for Ecologic and WBAI to exist.
And we continue to offer you important news, information, and entertainment. So we need you. And most of our premiums can be found on their own webpage, ecologic.wbai.org. Leave out the www and on www.give2wbai.org.
And we thank our own special engineer today, Ken Gale.
With Ken, I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us Friday, October 28th at our usual 2:30 p.m. for Reflections on Superstorm Sandy.
We're in a unique moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird, heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our station!
Whose control?
Our control!
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. for the Independent News Hour, the weekly radio show of The Independent, New York City's radical newspaper. Each week, we speak with the activists, organizers, and social movement thought leaders who are fighting for a more just and equitable New York. That's The Independent News Hour, Tuesdays, 5 to 6 p.m., only here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Oh, vaccination.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.